You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We are the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of anyone at KDUX, Richland College, or the DCCD. Today is the last show before the spring break, and when I came in today, the studio was locked up. Our technical engineer apparently has the afternoon off. Fortunately, I was able to find someone to let me in. So we're going to have a show, but it's going to have to be a 1 hour, 1 hour and a half maximum, because the person that let me in has to leave early, or at 5, so which is normally the end of the show, but I usually have some post-production to get the podcast up, and that usually takes me about 30 minutes, sometimes a little bit longer. So I've decided I'll definitely go an hour, hour and 15 minutes, and then cut it short and, you know, wish you a happy spring break. We still have classes for those that attend classes on Saturday and Sunday, but the campus will be closed starting Monday the 18th through the following Monday at 6 a.m. So the campus will be locked tight shut. So don't come to campus other than maybe to walk around, because all the buildings will be shut down, all the labs will be shut down. However, this Saturday and Sunday, the Del Rio Computer Lab, for example, as well as the Multimedia Lab, will be open for students that have homework, as well as for students that have classes on Saturdays and Sundays. And in case I forget, I want to wish you all a very happy spring break. Catch up on your studies, or go have some fun, or catch up on your sleep, whatever. Today, I'm going to have two segments. One will be on the election of a new pope, and the second will be on illegal immigration in terms of what the ICE, or the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, did in releasing over 2,000 criminal aliens into your communities. Initially, the White House denied and basically said it was only a few hundred and these are minor criminals. The more I've dug into it, and other reporters have dug into it, the numbers are in the thousands. These people have, many of them, committed felonies or have multiple misdemeanor offenses. So these are not, and it's very difficult just to even get arrested, not arrested, but detained in these centers. It's you have to meet a criteria, and basically, if you're a criminal from the country of origin, or a repeat offender in terms of breaking into the country, that's what it takes to get into these detention centers. Because ICE normally will not detain people that have just here illegally. They will cut them loose. You know, if you've ever tried to report someone, they won't come out. It's that simple. Unless you have somebody that's truly a criminal, they won't pick them up. And that's why a lot of your local police don't mess with it, because it takes time and they're not really going to follow through. So I'll get into that. And if we have a little time, I'll highlight what I'll be doing the following week when we come back. And if you've been listening to the news, the Democratic, both the Republicans and the Democrats have put forward their budget proposals in the House Budget Committee presented its budget for, and this is for fiscal year 2014, and for the first time in nearly 4 years, the Senate is actually going to have a budget. Now, keep in mind, by law, they're required to have a budget every year, but they ignore the law. They're basically law breaking. I think it's reprehensible, because they're paid money to do their job, and part of their job, most important part of the job, is to prepare a budget bill that after they passed it goes to a conference committee where the House bill and the Senate bill are basically scrubbed. And you have common language. You're going to have some horse trading going on, because the House is controlled by the Republicans, and the Senate is controlled by the Democratic Party. So they're going to be fairly far apart. So I'll just touch on that and what I see happening. And keep in mind, the president was supposed to submit a budget, again by law, and this is the third time in a row he hasn't submitted it on time. Usually he's been only a couple of weeks late. But by law, the first Monday of February, the president of the United States, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, is required by law to submit their budget proposal. Well, that was, I believe, February 5th. We're still, and this is March 15th. And the latest news I have, it will be probably sometime in April, the second week in April, before we can expect to see the president's budget. So we have an interesting situation where the House Republicans are doing their job, doing it in a timely manner, as required by law. But the Democrats, both in the Senate for going on four years, never held budget hearings. And the president, again, is being late as usual. I frankly think the budget has been prepared. It's just been sitting in someone's desk. And when they get around to it, they're going to release it. I think this time the president said, I'll go last. I'll wait to see what the House proposes as well as what his own party proposes in the Senate. And the reason why is in the last couple of years, when his budget has gone forward, it's been voted down by both the Republican and the Democratic parties because it's excessive. It perpetuates another trillion-dollar deficit. So I'm very interested in what the president's budget is, and I'm very concerned about where we'll end up if we'll have a balanced budget in my lifetime, because the Republicans are saying it'll be at least 10 years, and the Democrats, they don't even give a year. So, you know, individuals, families, businesses, colleges, cities, states, all have to balance their budget, but we have a federal government that hasn't done it. And really, the last eight decades, it's only been a few years that we've actually had a balanced budget, and even that is somewhat misleading. So I'll touch upon that. I really am not going to get into much detail for the simple reason it's rather early, but I ran across, however, the Heritage Foundation has what they call Saving the American Dream budget, which I want to at least touch on, because although I disagree with several of the items, specifics of their plan, they at least have the right idea in the sense that they would balance the budget in 4 years. And quite frankly, I think that's all we have. Because if we continue down this road, if you listen to the past show, we have a debt time bomb that's ticking. And what I mean by that is at some point interest rates are going to start climbing as we have inflation. And as that happens, what's going to happen to the cost of the interest expense, which today is, I think it's a hair under $300 million, about 10%, about one out of every $10 of our tax revenue is spent on interest. And that's really low. What you're going to have happen is the more debt you have, it's just like having a credit card, the more interest you're going to have to pay. And when interest rates goes up, you're going to have a double whammy. And I've looked at statistics, especially what the Heritage Foundation has put out, and the three, actually four major items that are the major expenses are Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, including and also Obamacare and CHIP, and interest. Those are your major expenses, and by the year 2025, those categories alone, remember, I haven't talked about any other department, including defense, just those categories, basically entitlements, your Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, Obamacare, and interest on the national debt, will be around a little over 18% of revenues. Now, why is that important? Because historically, that's the tax revenue over many decades with high tax rates, low tax rates, in terms of total revenues that the tax system collects, it's approximately a little over 18% of the gross domestic product, real gross domestic product. And that doesn't pay. And that's why we've had these massive deficits, because when you're in a depression or a recession, the actual collections are below that. And that's exactly what's happened. And the point I'm trying to highlight, as well as the Heritage Foundation is highlighting, is that if we do not get our spending under control within 13 years, 12 years, we'll be in a situation where just entitlements will eat all tax collections. So one of two things have to happen. I think both things will have to happen. All spending will have to be drastically cut. We need major reforms in entitlement, and that's what the Heritage Foundation is recommending, as well as Paul Ryan and a number of people. You know, to the extent that you want to save Social Security and Medicare, you need fundamental reforms in those programs. Social Security is probably the easiest one to do, and I'll get into that. I'm sort of giving you some highlights as to what I'll be getting into in the next coming weeks, because this is the budgets in Washington, D.C. This is the budget season, and this impacts you and me, because we're going into the fifth year where we've had substantially high unemployment rates. You know, the normal situation is your employment rate is between 4 and 5%. In full employment, although you'll get a debate among economists, or near full employment, is somewhere between 3 and 4%. You'll get an argument as to where it lies. And the normal business situation, depending on where you are in the business cycle, 4 or 5% is kind of the new norm, if you will. But we're at double that. We're at the lowest rate, frankly, since President Obama has been in office, was last month at 7.7. You know, when he took office, it was 7.8%, and last month it was at 7.7%. But if you dug into the numbers, what you found is the reason why the unemployment rate actually went down is you had discouraged workers, people leaving the labor force, of over 296,000. And that's important. So although the unemployment has been bouncing around, you know, 8.1, 8.2, or 7.8, 7.9, it's really more or less stabilized in the 8% area, you know, plus or minus a couple of tenths of percent. Now, if we go into recession, I think we're going to see much higher numbers. The important point is we need the economy to get growing, and we're not going to, as long as Washington, D.C., whether it's the Republican or Democratic parties, keep running these massive deficits, you're not going to get on a growth path. You know, in the fourth quarter, we essentially had zero growth. It was 0.1. Those are the revised numbers. And it fell from the third quarter of 3.1. And the reason why that's important, usually the fourth quarter is your best quarter. So we're slipping into a recession. And once the numbers come out, which they will, and starting in April, May, and June, we'll get the numbers for the first quarter as well as the final revision for the fourth quarter. I think you're going to see it both in the growth rates of GDP as well as the unemployment numbers. So I'm not very optimistic, and that's going to hurt students that are looking for jobs. It's that simple. The unemployment rate for teenagers, that's 16, 17, 18, and 19-year-olds, is at 25.1%. 25.1%. And if you're a minority, such as a black, it's almost double that. And remember, the minimum wage today is $7.25. Obama's proposed a $9 rate. What that's going to do is take the unemployment rate for teenagers, which most college students are. I know some of you are older, in 20s. But the teenage unemployment rate is usually double or more the national average. In this case, it's over three times. And it's been these are the highest teenage, the last 4 years have been the highest teenage unemployment rates. You know, you can go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics.gov, BLS.gov, and get all this information. It's not secret. I'm not telling you anything you can look up, and you can see what I'm telling you. We've had teenage unemployment rates in the 20%, 20 to 25% range, and actually above 25%. This is not the first time it's been at 25% or above. Those are, that's over three times the national average of 7.7. Not double, three times. So it's very, very difficult. That means one out of four teenagers can't find a job. Period. And because you have mandated the federal government as well as the state governments can and do mandate a minimum wage, that means teenagers that would be quite willing to work for $5 an hour, $6 an hour, even $7 an hour, can't because by law, the federal, in Texas, they're the same, but in some states you actually have states have higher minimum wages. If you're lucky to find a job, yeah, $9 beats $7.25. I'd be the first one to say that's right. But what you're forgetting is, just because the government mandates a minimum wage doesn't mean a business owner has to hire you. And if he already has people employed where their productivity, they're only worth $7.25, in many cases maybe even less, when the minimum wage, and I think it will pass. I could be wrong on this. I think it's a big mistake. But should the minimum wage go to $9, I fully expect another spike in the teenage unemployment rate, and it'll be over 30%. So if you're lucky to have a job, yeah, $9 beats $7.25. But what about all the people who are making zero? You know, you can be a well-intentioned do-gooder, but what about all those people that would work for $4, $5, $6, even $7, but can't find the job, have no job? And I'll caution you about government statistics. They tend to understate the problem. Because the U3 unemployment rate, which is the headline unemployment rate, that's the 7.7% number, is just one of six unemployment numbers that the Bureau of Labor Statistics provides each month. Economists follow the U6, or total unemployment rate, that includes people that are discouraged from working, what's called your marginally attached worker, as well as people who have found part-time work but are looking for permanent work. That rate is over 14%. And we need to talk in terms of the U3, the low rate, represents right around 12 million people. The U6 rate is right around the high 23 million. That's a lot of people, folks, looking for a job. And it doesn't include the long rate, what's called the long term discouraged worker that have been looking for a job and have not find it, because there are other private organizations that think that their statistics indicate that we're at about a 20% unemployment rate, which is about 30 million people. So, you know, whether you want to rely on government statistics or not, we have tens of millions of Americans looking for permanent work that can't find it. And the answer is not higher and higher minimum wage. You know, we could increase the minimum wage rate to $20, but what would that do? Then instead of having 25% teenage unemployment, we'd probably have 75%, because a lot of employers would simply lay off their workers because they're not productive. Remember, most teenagers looking for work, it's either their first, second, or maybe third job. They're unskilled, they have very little work experience, and what happens is the employer has to spend time training them for whatever the job is. Even if it's not something that involves a lot of training, you got to remember, employers, whether it's a business, they're not charities. And that's important to keep in mind. They're not charities. They hire you because they need your services and your skills. And if you don't have many skills and cannot provide many services, you're not going to be worth much to them. You know, it needs to be keep in mind, there are about 75 million Americans today that are hourly workers. Of those 75 million, over 70 million make more than the minimum wage. Many of them make many, many times more. 3 times, 4, 5, 10 times more than minimum wage. It depends on your skill sets. So the private enterprise is really where the jobs are. And if you're looking for a new job, I mean, if you're looking for employment, the best place to look are small businesses, new small businesses, because they're the ones responsible for most, not all, but most of the job growth. You know, as a new business expands its operations, it hires people. That's why I always tell people, if you're looking for a job, go, walk the streets and go into local small businesses. Knock on doors or make phone calls, whichever you're more comfortable with, or send resumes to. I think it's more impressive, though, to walk in, dress up, coat and tie, walk in, introduce yourself, and simply ask, are you hiring? I'm looking for a job. They'll probably ask you what you can do. Some will ask for a resume. Some will ask you to fill out a job application. But that's how you get a job, especially if you're unskilled. And there are jobs out there. The problem most people are running into, and I know this from firsthand experience, there are literally, for every job that's out there, there are dozens of applications. And especially when you're talking unskilled, most teenagers are doing what I would consider unskilled work. It could be a janitor. It could be a landscaper. It could be stocking shelves. It could be a cashier. Go to your local grocery store, for example. You have a number of jobs. You have baggers. I remember when I was a teenager, my first job was a bagger. And we didn't get paid a minimum wage. We got paid in tips. And we really had a hustle for those tips. And most of the people coming in, it was on a Saturday. So it was one day a week Saturday. That's when most people, I was overseas and as a kid, and it was a commissary. And that's where most of your military, your dependents, dad was off typically on a Saturday, so mom and dad would go to the commissary and shop, and they usually would shop for a week. So you'd have to hustle. You'd have a crew on each cash register, and you got strictly tips. Money went in. So you typically had 3 or 4 people bagging because you really had to move. We had long, long lines. And it was strictly tips, no salary at all, no minimum salary. And it was a good paying job. It gave you a sense of what work is. You had to show up on time. And a lot of times you might not be selected. There'd be a list of people, and they might only need 30 baggers, 30 or 40 baggers. And, you might have 60 people. So it very much depended on the luck of the draw. Everyone would get a number, and it would go down, and it'd have a cutoff. So it was hard even getting the job, and if you got the job, you had to hustle because you had to – and these bags were big bags, not these short ones that you have now. And I filled many a grocery cart with, 8 to 10 bags, and you had to know how to pack them right. And so that's a little bit my experience with below the minimum wage. When, there was a minimum wage, but so what? We were overseas. Federal law didn't apply. Enough said. One reason I got on this topic is I wrote an article on not this issue, but the previous issue on the minimum wage, and we had some reaction to it. And what I think needs to be underscored is the simple fact that just because the federal government mandates a minimum wage doesn't mean an employer needs to hire you. It doesn't mean an employer necessarily will keep you. Because I'll be brutally honest, many of the people are not worth at the existing current minimum wage, especially when they're brand new. They have to be trained. And it's very, very simple. What you are worth in the market is what someone else will pay for your services. And if they don't think your services are worth $7.25, guess what? They're not going to hire you. And they're certainly not going to hire you at $9. So if you don't have the skill sets that they're interested in, even though it might be very, very basic, from stocking a shelf to bagging groceries to being a cashier, sorry. And again, where you have a free market as opposed to where you have government interference, you have the freedom to negotiate something lower. And that's something that needs to be said. There are people today going unemployed that are earning nothing. It's zero. They would much prefer to have a job at some wage. Now, I don't know what the prevailing wage is in Dallas, but it's somewhere probably between $5 and $7. Now, the minimum wage is $7.25. Now, if you didn't have the minimum wage, there are employers in Dallas that would pay you $5 or $6 to work. But they legally can't. Now, some do. Some will do it under the table. But most will not do it, won't touch you. And that's the problem. You know, I make it very simple. You know, if you work 40 hours a week, 50 weeks, that's 2,000 hours. Multiply 2,000 hours by $5. That's $10,000. Yeah, that's going to be very difficult to live on. I'd be the first one to say it. But what's your alternative? Zero? Would you like to go an entire year and earn zero? Because that's what the do-gooders are doing when they want a higher minimum wage. I always, when someone tells me, you know, I think they should get $9, and it's going to be difficult. Well, why not make it double at 18? Well, I'll tell you why. And they know it deep down. They know why they don't want to make it 18. Because if they made it 18, the teenage unemployment rate wouldn't be 25%. It would be 50, 60%. Because most employers cannot afford that. Like I said, they're not a charity. They have to sell goods and services. They got to make a profit. And they got to cover their overhead, such as rent, electricity, taxes, payroll taxes. You know, that's why, you know, most people that haven't been in business don't know this, but I've been in business. You usually have markups on any good is 50% or 50 to 100% minimum markup, sometimes many times more, depending on the good. What's the margin? And some like a grocery store, is very low margin. So keep in mind why higher minimum wage might be very attractive, and it sounds really good, especially if you're making the minimum wage today. If it should go up to $9, I know what's going to happen. Some people are going to be laid off, and other people are never going to get a job offer, and the unemployment rate will definitely go up higher and higher. You know, for 3 years, I think it was, I might be off a year. I think it's 2007, 2008, and 2009, the minimum wage went up. And as it went up, every year you see a spike higher and higher and higher. That's why you've had, that's why the teenage unemployment rate is so high today. You know, and what's interesting, people a lot smarter than me who had have studied this, setting high minimum wage historically has been used to discriminate against blacks and minorities in this country. You see, the big supporters of higher minimum wage are the unions. Because they, if you make that the law, at least in the past, that forced the employer not to hire blacks at less than the minimum wage. And there were blacks at the time that would work for less than the minimum wage. So one way to discriminate against blacks was to increase the dollar amount of the minimum wage. So there's a lot of history involved. So why good intentions? You always have do-gooders with good intentions that'll give you the story of how difficult it is to live on a minimum wage. I'll be the first one to say it is difficult to live on a minimum wage. I have, and actually less. And I've also earned a lot more. It depends on how old you are, what skill set you are, and what you're looking for, and what you'll settle for. And when you're in a recession, which I think we still are, where you've had unemployment rates above 7% now going on 5 years, it's difficult to get a job. That's a lot of people. Those are millions of people. And the minimum wage does not make it better. It does make it better for the ones that get a higher minimum wage. There's no argument there. That's just common sense. But what you need to factor into your thinking is the millions of, in teenagers, you're talking hundreds of thousands of teenagers that can't find jobs. And what you're seeing more and more, college graduates that can't find jobs. You know, they go to college for 2 years or 4 years, then they try to get a job and they can't. Or they settle. They settle for a part-time job at a minimum wage. You see, ideas and economic policies have consequences, and you got to look at the unintended consequences. Good intentions are terrific, but if they lead to consequences that you did not intend, then I don't think it's a good policy. You know, that's why I'm in favor for abolishing the minimum wage. You see, in some places, the minimum wage does not have any effect. And the reason why is the prevailing wage or market wage for entry-level jobs are much above the minimum wage. For example, in North Dakota, where they've had where you basically have a boom in because of the oil and natural gas find up there, you have jobs, for example, at a McDonald's at $15 or more, and they can't find people at $15. Now, can you live at $15 an hour? You know, if you're in Dow, oh, that's terrific. You know, that's a $30,000 job. The problem is, yeah, they'll pay you $15, but it's hard to find places to live. You got to keep it. You got to keep it in perspective. So no one in his right mind could hire anybody at the minimum wage. Now, you could go to $15 an hour, and what would happen? In Montana, nothing, because that's the market wage. What would happen in Dallas is you would have a lot of unemployed teenagers, and it's not just teenagers. The majority of the people that are young people in their 20s are the majority of the ones. And there's been a study of this. And I have, you know, if you want more information, I really wasn't going to get on this, but somehow I did my detour. What I suggest you do is go to my, I have two blogs, and I need to say this. I have a companion blog for this show. It's pronkpops.wordpress.com. That's pronkpops.wordpress.com. That is for the show. But I also have what I call my main blog, and that's Pronk Palisades. And the way to get, and the URL for that is www.raymondpronk.wordpress.com. And I have the economic consequences of the minimum wage. Now I add 1, 2, 3, 4, even 5 posts probably every day. So you're going to have to look for it. I published it this month, though, so it should come up in the list. So just look for March of 2013, and it's in the archives, because in the March archives. And I have a number of videos on that. And the very, very first video is the one I'd recommend. It's only about a minute. That really explains this in detail. So for those that are interested in this and the consequences of the minimum wage, in terms of employment opportunities, from a business perspective as well as from a worker perspective, I suggest you watch that first video, but I also have a lot of other videos that get into this various aspects. And I also have a lot of history at the bottom that gives you detailed information. A lot of it's from the Department of Labor, Bureau of Labor Statistics, and they what I was going to say is they've done a study as to what are the characteristics. I believe they update this annually. The last update was 2011. I'm sure sometime this year they'll do it for 2012. And they basically break out by characteristics, by age, by sex, gender, as well as race, the characteristics of those that are on the minimum wage, how many are hourly, and it's just not only at the minimum wage. Many people, there are occupations where you earn less than a minimum wage because you're getting a lot of tips. So that's my spiel on the minimum wage. And again, the only reason why I did this 2 weeks ago, and not this issue, but the previous issue, I did a little article on Obama's proposal to increase the minimum wage to $9. And I gave my thoughts. And I need to say this. I'm not the only economist. I think it's fairly most reputable economist. It's not unanimous. But the vast majority of economists are not in favor of the minimum wage. They simply are not, because they are well aware of what it does. You see, when it's too low and below the prevailing market wage, it doesn't have any effect. When it really hurts people is when you set the minimum wage significantly above what the labor market in a specific locale provides, and that's the danger of it, and that has the consequence of having people that normally would work and could work, and employers would hire them, but when you constrain the employer and say you have to pay them a certain amount, well, the employer, you know, puts pencil to paper and basically decides whether or not you're worth hiring or not. And what happens is when it's significantly above what the skills of the person has to offer, invariably that means they're not hired. Okay, let's go back to what I was going to really start the show, and that's it. We have a new pope, Pope Francis. He was elected Wednesday, and I was listening to it, and the tradition in the Vatican is they've had a number of votes, and if black smoke comes out of the chimney, that indicates they have not elected a pope. And when white smoke comes out of the chimney, they have elected a pope. And usually, half an hour to an hour later, you'll have an announcement. A cardinal will come out and announce, "We have a pope," and announce the name of the cardinal that was elected pope, what name he will be known as. And it was Francis, Pope Francis. And that is, I understand now, and I thought it was the case, but I've confirmed it. He took the name Francis from St. Francis Assisi. And I have provided in my notes for this segment, you can actually view two terrific movies, two movies on St. Francis Assisi. One was in 1972, and another one was in 1989. I don't want to get into that, other than if you're interested in learning more about why he chose the name, then I would go to that, go to those movies. And another movie that I would really strongly recommend, it's been many years since I've watched it, but is the movie In the Shoes of the Fisherman, that give you a sense of how they go about electing and choosing a pope. And it's, I think, a very good movie. I noticed on YouTube that this, you know, there were a number of, you can for $1.99, you can watch the movie. So It's not for free, and there's I've given you a few clips. I've given you the trailer. I have seen the movie. I would strongly recommend it. It stars Anthony Quinn as the cart. Well, as he was in a he was in Siberia as a prisoner when he was released by the Soviets. And he was they took him back to Rome. He was made a cardinal, and subsequent to that, the Pope died. And then they obviously have a vacancy, and they elected him. And it's a very good movie, interesting movie. And I, if you have time and it's your cup of tea, I suggest you watch the movie. What's interesting about the Pope that they elected is the first pope in over 1,000 years that is a non-European pope. We've actually had a pope in the past that was from Syria. But this is the first pope that from the Americas, which includes South America. He's from Argentina. His parents were of Italian descent, so he speaks both Italian and Spanish. He is, I think, what would be considered in the Catholic Church a conservative. What was also unique about it, he is a Jesuit. And Jesuits are the, I guess the way to explain it, are the intellectuals or teachers. They have orders. He went through the monastery, became a priest. It's rare that you have, he is the first not only American from the Americas Pope, he's the first from the Jesuit order. And I think the reason why is they're sort of the shock troops of the Catholic Church. They go into, they're primarily a teaching order. But one problem with it, especially in Latin America, some of the Jesuits, not the entire order, were in the 70s and 80s, actually in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, were promoting liberation theology, which, as far as I'm concerned, is not Catholicism, not even Christianity, but they were promoting that. So there, you know, ears perked up when that, I know the background of it, but you need to be aware of that. But what's interesting, he's very, from everything I gather, well, a couple of points. When the last pope was elected, supposedly this cardinal was number two and did not want to be elected pope and told them, I don't want to be pope. Please support Benedict, which they did. And, Benedict became pope. I did not expect him, because of his age, he's 76. If you listen to the past show, I thought they were going to elect somebody in their in the 60s. The average age of the cardinals, I understand, is approximately 73. So he's older than the average, and I truly thought they were going to elect a pope that was much younger. Instead, because this cardinal that was elected pope apparently is very popular amongst the cardinals. He's well-liked. Everyone that knows him was very complimentary about him. He's very friendly. He's very humble. He's also a scholar. And what I didn't know is that in his own country, Argentina is run by socialists. And they exiled him to kind of the frontier. And he taught math in schools in a remote location. And then he was elevated to both bishop, archbishop, cardinal, and now pope. And it's interesting because about 40% of all Catholics today are from South America. They're the fastest growing portion of the people that are Catholics. So I think it's a very interesting choice. A very I wasn't surprised except for the age. Like I said, I really thought they were gonna elect an Italian pope that was in his 60s. Apparently not.
And it's interesting who they did select. Now, I don't know that much about them other than, you know, what I've heard and read. It'd be interesting to follow. What was interesting following the commentary is because he's very conservative, he's a Catholic. They're going to be pro-life. They're not going to be for abortion. They're not going to be for Planned Parenthood. And they're not going to be for gay marriage. You know, and some of the commentary, you know, well, Americans, kind of parochial as they are, well, what about that? Aren't they considering the fact? Well, no. You know, Catholicism is a religion or faith. It's a matter of belief. And if you're Catholic, you believe that abortions are murder. They're pro-life. And that homosexual acts are sins. They're not going to support gay marriage. You know, this pope or any cardinal that they elected was not going to change Catholicism. But the commentators were, you know, and that needs to be emphasized. The Catholic Church is a faith. People that believe in certain things, certain doctrines. You know, that's kind of fundamental and basic. You know, if you don't believe, you know, if you believe in gay marriage, if you believe in abortion, fine, but guess what? You probably shouldn't be a Catholic. You know, is that simple. It's not hard. I know there are Catholics that do. And many of our politicians, quite frankly, should be excommunicated from the Catholic Church. And that's a matter of discretion on their bishop, wherever they're going to church, and the bishop that's in charge of it, or the cardinal for that matter. And that's a point that non-Catholics point out. Why don't you, why aren't these people that obviously are not following Catholic doctrines, why aren't they excommunicated? Well, it's discretionary. In many cases, they're well-known politicians. If they were in another diocese, going to another church, that would happen. You know, there's, you know, Pelosi, this former Speaker of the House, our current Secretary of State, as well as our Vice President, are three examples of Catholics that are enunciating political policies that are against the teachings of the Catholic Church. No ifs, ands, or buts. And I frankly wish the Pope, the Cardinals, and the Bishops would enforce it and excommunicate them. It's not a good example to the rest of society. But I point this out, it's a matter of discretion from basically whoever the bishop is in charge of the diocese. So we do have a new pope, Pope Francis. I wish him well. Everything I hear about him, I like. I think a story that I would have felt refreshing, the day after he's elected, he got in one of these small, like, motor scooter type cars, got in it, he was dressed as the Pope, went to the hotel he was staying and picked up his luggage. That's the kind of person he is. And he didn't want to be elected Pope, which is also refreshing. I think that should be, if you really want to be elected Pope, you probably shouldn't be elected Pope. So I really wish him well, wish the Catholic Church well in this regard. I think it's an interesting selection. And he looks healthy. I think 8 to 10 years minimum, maybe longer. We had a first Pope Benedict resigned the office, and now is Pope Benedict Emeritus Pope. And that was a first, because most of the popes die. I thought Pope Benedict did the right thing. If you're really not up to the job physically, I think it's best for everybody to resign, even though that's seldom done, and I think that was refreshing that he did, and I think it's terrific that they elected Pope Francis. Well, I'll move on to the next segment, because I normally do not do religion or religious topics, because I think that is a matter of faith. The one thing I needed to add, though, I was listening to a talk radio show, and someone called in and made an excellent, it was the Rush Limbaugh show, by the way, and it made an excellent point that you shouldn't confuse politics and religion. It seems obvious, because see what's happened is, especially if you're on the left, whether you're a communist, a socialist, a social democrat, progressive, whatever brand of collectivism that you support, what many do is their politics becomes their religion. It's not an accident that Marx, as well as the communist, they don't want competition, and they consider religion and people of faith, especially Christians, as competition. So they are mostly atheists. Almost all of them are, not all of them, but a lot of them are atheists. They close churches. They execute people of faith, whether it's Catholics or Protestants. They're known to do this, both in the Soviet Union and in communist China and other communist nations. They don't want religion to be a force in people's lives. And their faith, if you will, is their ideology. And I think that's true. And I think that's one of the reasons why you had this sort of interesting reaction amongst commentators that, let's face it, their faith today is the Democratic Party. They're progressives. Liberals, progressives, socialists, whatever. I don't care, Whatever you prefer to call yourselves. And they've abandoned their faith, whatever it is. It could be Catholicism. It could be Methodism. It could be Lutheranism. It could be Presbyterians, Mormons, Baptists, various Jewish, temples, various... they've abandoned their religions, and now their religion is really their politics. And they're confusing. If it's a matter of faith, they believe certain things. The trouble is the people that you really need to challenge is the politicians. I have very little faith at all in any politicians. I don't care if they're Republicans or Democrats. Because unfortunately, we have, I think, massive corruption. And it takes the form, some of it is blatant. We've had the recent trial and conviction of Jesse Jackson Jr. in Chicago. That's the more crude form of it. But what happens is that you have people with a lot of money, so-called special interests. A lot of them are... in the financial sector, but it also unions, as well as, there are a number of major, I would say, the legal bar, for example, litigators that give large contributions to political candidates of both parties, to the extent that the politician becomes very much beholden to those whoever gave the most money, and they get access, and whatever law or regulation they want largely gets passed. That might be a cynical view, but I think it's just reality. It's not new. I'm not saying anything is new. I think the extent of it in terms of the sheer size is new. But for those that are very wealthy, or in terms of unions, have, a source of money being union dues and people that can, for example, get out the vote, politicians are largely bought and paid for. And I think it's getting worse. And what happens is, instead of the general welfare being the primary concern, what becomes the primary concern is making sure that your campaign contributors get taken care of in a host of ways. You know, that's the quid pro quo. You know, who benefits? So, and that is really driving a lot of politics in America today. And that's why I think we're in the situation where we basically have a deadlock. You have special interests on both sides supporting certain wings of both political parties and demand their pound of flesh. It could be higher taxes. It could be a change in the tax law. It could be subsidies. You know, you name it. So why the actual paying off of politicians might be the exceptions, there are other ways that politicians are paid off, and it's largely campaign contributions. And they're bought cheap. Because many, especially I know in the financial sector, the payoff is huge, hundreds, thousands of percent, if you can get changes in the regulations that work in your favor. And you can call me cynical, but that's just the way it works. If you don't believe me, go buy some gasoline, see what the price is. By a simple change in the regulations, that price of gasoline, a gallon of gasoline, be cut in half. Why isn't it? Because both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, in key positions in the House and the Senate, including the President, have been paid off. And who does it hurt? It hurts everybody that buys gasoline in the United States. And that'll be a separate show. I'm very on the brink of committing to writing a book on it because I think it's scandalous and it has repercussions. It does massive harm. You see, ultimately, I think what's going to happen, we're within the next 10 to 20 years, there's a revolution going on in oil and gas in the sense that the amount of proven reserves is like 200, 300 years of proven reserves of natural gas, for example. Now, natural gas can be used for a lot of things, but one primary area it can be used for is for the primary fuel for electrical generation. So I think more of your newer plants are going to be natural gas plants, as well as conversions of, for example, coal to natural gas. And I think that's wonderful because that'll happen because natural gas is cheap. Where you have an abundant supply, and I think, you know, 100, 200, 300 years plus, and we're just scratching the surface. We're just really getting started. Now, what needs to be done to take advantage of those fines, major fines, is the fact that you're going to need new pipelines and you're going to need new refining new refineries to get, you need refineries to process the natural gas as well as pipelines to send it to, for example, electrical generation plants. And all that needs to be built. Those are literally hundreds, if not millions, of jobs right there. And most of this has been being done on private property. It's not being done only to a small percentage on federal property. So I think what you're going to see, and you've seen it already, dramatic drops in the price of natural gas, but natural gas can also be converted to gasoline, first methane and then to gasoline. That's one possibility, as well as we're finding oil as well. And that is a direct result of directional drilling and that's been used for many years, but it's been refined and refined and refined. And what's great about it, you can have one, what most people would consider an oil well, but that they can dig that, when they dig that well, and usually they go 10, 15, 20,000, well, 10 to 15,000 on land deeper offshore. They, once they get down to the depth to where they want, they can use that one well to really hit a number of reservoirs or pools of either oil or natural gas. So it's a very efficient and productive way to tap in to either natural gas finds or oil. So what you're going to see is the United States will become energy independent. Again, it's going to take years to do it, and that's going to involve a lot of investment, but that's going to employ a lot of people, not only in oil and gas, but also in generating electricity. And I think it's going to be a revolution in the United States in the sense that it's going to make electrical power as well as transportation costs fall, which is what we need. So I'm looking forward to that. So I think ultimately that's what's going to happen, but that's going to take time. And I think the United States also will become an exporter of gasoline, petroleum, crude, as well as natural gas. But I don't want to get into that because there's some technical issues there. But I think you're going to see a resurgence of the United States, because that makes the United States very, very attractive for manufacturing. I think a lot of manufacturing, not all, but a lot of manufacturing that has gone overseas will come back to the extent that it can. And again, it's not going to happen overnight or in a year or two. We're probably talking 10 to 20 years. But that's, and this all has really happened in the last 5 years. And that's an exciting, very positive note, because I think that's what we really need to, if you will, reboot or restart or get on a really positive, significant growth rate. Because the economy right now has been growing on average right around 2-2.5%. That's below the historical trend of 3.3%. You know, that's why unemployment rates are, you know, high sevens, 8%, and for most of the last 4 years have been over 9%. You need economic growth because jobs are created in the private sector primarily by new businesses, not in the government sector. Yeah, government hires people at federal, state, city, colleges. But that's not where the majority of the new jobs are. The majority of the new jobs that are created in the United States are in the private sector and by small businesses. And one of the costs of doing business is your electrical and transportation. You know, any business needs electrical power to run your computers, your air conditioning, your lights. And you also need an air conditioning if you're in Texas, or heating. So to the extent that the cost of electrical power goes down over time, that's positive. And the same thing with the cost of transportation, because you need to transport goods to whatever business, as well as whether you're doing a good or services, you're going to need transportation, whether it's a truck or car, auto. So to the extent that the United States becomes energy independent and oil prices go down, you're going to see the cost of transportation go up. That's very, very positive, both where your energy and transportation costs are going down. That's terrific, and that's good for jobs. So I'm really an optimist long term. What I am very pessimistic about is government intervention into the economy. And it's always well-intentioned. The problem is they do have consequences. You know, we're going into our fifth year of deficits of over $1 trillion. And because the The House today is controlled by the Republicans. The Senate is controlled by the Democrats. And obviously the president is a Democrat. We're going to have divided government until 2017. Yeah, the Senate could go Republican in 2016. I doubt seriously the House will go Democratic. So for all practical purposes, we have divided government. So I'm seeing people ask me, well, Ray, what do you think? What's going to happen over the next 4 years? I'm going to say it's more of the same. Slow economic growth and high what economists call structural unemployment. That's a polite way of saying permanent unemployment. And, yeah, given if we're going to keep running these massive deficits, in other words, a deficit is where we're spending more money than we're collecting. And that's roughly, for every dollar we're spending, we're going at debt about 40 cents on the dollar. But as debt, you know, I was talking to someone just before the show, and I pointed out, a lot of people aren't aware of this, but our central bank, the Federal Reserve, every month is buying $90 billion of government securities, and they divided up $45 billion or treasury securities and $45 billion or what's called mortgage-backed securities. But those are mortgage-backed securities issued by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who are they're called the government-sponsored enterprises. They're owned and controlled now by the federal government. That's money financing both the federal government and those government agencies. And you do the math. Multiply $90 billion by 12. So most of your trillion-dollar deficit for the federal government, most if not all, is being financed by the Federal Reserve. In other words, we're creating or printing money, but technically it's not printing money because they don't need to print money. We do have people with keyboards and networks that are connected. And the way the Federal Reserve, which is a central bank, pays for government securities is they give them a credit on their account, the federal government a credit on their account. They're creating money. And to the extent that that money is injected into the economy in terms of credit or loans, what you're going to see is inflation. It's just a matter of time. We're seeing it already. But it's whether it's this year or next year, who knows, we're going to see, unfortunately, I think very much a repeat of what happened in the 70s. And see, once inflation expectations set in, and I think they're setting in right now, inflation is on its way, which means your money will be worth, in terms of purchasing power, less and less. And you'll see that as prices across the board go up. See, that's the danger of this inflationary Keynesian economics type policy. You know, in the short run, it seems to work. In the long run, it doesn't. It turns into inflation. And that's hard to control once it gets going. And I frankly don't think the Federal Reserve, this is my opinion, doesn't have an exit strategy. You know, we have basically it's monetary policy by PhDs. That's our gold standard today, PhDs from, MIT, Princeton, Harvard, you know, the leading universities, Berkeley. The problem, they think they know better than the marketplace. And they don't. They don't. It's a command and control where what they're commanding and controlling is the price of money. We've had interest rates now for going on 5 years that have been near zero. No one can tell me that would be the market rate of interest. That's absurd. If you didn't have government intervention, the market rates across the board would be going up at least 2 to 3%, 200 or 300 basis points, I was going to say, but put it in percent. So we've had manipulation by the Federal Reserve of interest rates, and that will lead to inflation. They're keeping the cost of what the federal government has to pay down. Nothing against that, but it can't continue forever because the primary mission, actually there are two missions of the, I think, unarguably most economists would agree, of any central bank, is to be a lender of last resort. In other words, to prevent runs on financial institutions such as commercial banks. In the past, it was just commercial banks. Now it's broadened to more than that. To be a lender of last resort. In other words, where a bank is still solvent, in other words, its assets exceed its liabilities, but it has a liquidity problem, namely you have customers wanting their money out, the central bank, in this case the Federal Reserve, would provide the liquidity by loaning money to the financial institutions. It's a loan collateralized by the asset, certain types of assets, such as treasury securities, but also other securities. That's one of the primary missions of any central bank, including the Federal Reserve. The second is to keep the purchasing power of our currency stable. In that regard, the Federal Reserve has been a complete failure. So on their own record, and according to their primary mission, as far as I'm concerned, the Fed is a failure. That's why I'm for ending the Fed. It just hasn't. You know, when a $19.13 dollar today is worth about 3 cents, that's not price stability. A $19.13 dollar should be worth a dollar. In other words, what I could buy in $19.30, I should be able to buy today. No, I can't. You'd have to pay 20 times that. You know, that's inflation, folks. See, and that's what happened. That's what's happening when you have the Federal Reserve financing the federal government, where you have these runaway, out-of-control federal spending. You see, and they're all interrelated. I go through this, and to some extent I repeat myself, but I need to get it across. You can't every year, without fail, run $1 trillion deficits without having consequences. And those consequences are lower economic growth, which means higher unemployment, which means millions and millions of Americans can't find a job. That is the direct consequences of running these massive deficits. And we have both political parties, both Democrats and Republicans, are responsible for this. It's a bipartisan. There's enough blame to go around of both parties, and there's simply not the will to balance the budget. And next show, I'm going to get in more detail on it. You see, because what's happened is this week, as I said in my introduction, the House Budget Committee, chaired by Paul Ryan, put forward its budget. And it balances in 10 years. And let me say something. I was very critical, and am still critical, of the Republican Party and Paul Ryan, because previous year they would not have balanced until 2037. And I said, that's ridiculous. We don't have 25 years to balance it. You had maybe 3 or 4, and we've already gone through, we're in the middle of the second year, and they haven't made much, I won't say no progress, but very little progress in getting towards a balanced budget. Now, at least their goal of 10 years is much better. I'll be the first to concede that. But that's not going to happen because this Congress cannot bind future Congresses. That's why I say that what really you need to focus in on, really, your Congress is, when you're elected to be to Congress, you're elected for 2 years. So you're going to be responsible for 2 years. two budgets. So if you were elected or reelected in 2010, you're going to be responsible for the 2012 and 2013 budgets. And that's excuse me, if you were elected in 2010, you took office in 2011, which means at the time you took office, we're in the middle of fiscal year 2011. So the two budgets that you will be responsible would be 2012 and 2013, and we're in the 2013 now. What they're looking at right now is the 2014. Actually, it's 3 years, the more I think about it. There's an overlap. But that's all you commit, because remember, all money bills, all spending bills and tax bills must originate in the House, and then the Senate proposes their alternatives, and then you have a conference committee, and then you make compromises, and that becomes the budget. And when they look at the president's budget as well. Sometimes the president's budget becomes the House budget if they're of the same party. I don't want to complicate this. What the point I'm trying to make is it doesn't matter whether it's the Republicans or the Democrats. They're not balancing the budget this fiscal year or next fiscal year or the following fiscal year. They're telling you 10 years. The Democrats, it never balances. That's why I strongly favor the repeal of baseline budgeting. Because the problem with baseline budgeting is it's biased towards bigger and bigger governments, where the argument is not about the level of government spending, it's how much government spending will grow. And they play the games, these 10-year games. Stop the 10-year games. In other words, if every Congress had to balance the budget, that means they would have to budget to revenues, not a baseline, and not some arbitrary growth figure. And that's where they try to snow and mislead the American people. Because they say, well, we've cut, pick your number, $2 trillion, $3 trillion. They haven't cut a penny, not a penny. They'll say it with a straight face. I don't care if it's a Republican or Democrat. I've cut $2 trillion. And that could be Obama. And then Boehner, we've cut $3 trillion. I'm using the numbers just for examples. What they're talking about is that over the next 10 years, where most of those cuts are towards the end of that 10-year period. It's never up front. It's never the current year. It's insignificant. And it's the growth that they're talking about. They're not talking, when you and me talk cut, we're talking when I say the level. They never cut the level. They start with what the budget was last year, whatever level that is. Say 3.5 trillion and then add, you know, 10%, 5%, you know, you name a figure. That's what they do. They never actually cut the level. It goes up, up, and up. And see, the dirty little secret is, in tax revenues, if we go into recession, the federal government would be lucky to collect $2.5 trillion, which is $2,500 billion. Yet both parties' budgets, the Republican, the Democratic, and when the president gets around to getting his out in April, they're going to be 3.5, 3.6, 3.7, 3.8. Somewhere in that ballpark will be the outlays for fiscal year 2014. In other words, we're in for the sixth year of a $1 trillion deficit. It's hopeless. And they try to, both parties try to confuse you with these big cuts. They give you a big number. It sounds like they're doing a real lot. But always keep in mind, it's over 10 years. Most of those so-called cuts are not cuts in the level. They're cuts in the growth rate in those out years. And most importantly, today's Congress can't bind the Congress that gets elected 8 to 10 years from now. It's a joke. That's why I don't pay any attention to that. What I pay attention to is the current year we're in, which is 2013. The reason why I pay attention to it, they still have not agreed to what they have to the 27th of this month. And I'll get on it next show. We'll probably one of the segments will be on this. They have to pass what's called a continuing resolution. Why? They only budgeted for the first 6 months. They have to budget for the next 6 months. And the reason why they did that is they're tying it to, depending on what they decide on, to a certain extent, they will determine to what extent the debt level will go up to. Because they've suspended the increase in the debt ceiling until May. So I'll get into that. I'm looking at the time. I have another segment that I really am not going to have time to cover, other than because I got about 5 minutes to wrap it up. Because I said I'll go an hour and a half, and I'm about 5 minutes to that. What came out in the news this week is that not a couple of hundred illegal or criminal aliens were released from the detention centers, but 2,228 to date, and there's more to be released. You see, ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, has detention centers across the United States where illegal aliens are incarcerated. And it's hard to get in those detention centers. You not only have to be subject to removal from the country, namely, you entered this country illegally, but you also have had to commit either a felony or three, not one, not two, three misdemeanors. So, contrary to the press, initial press, that it's only a couple of hundred and the White House wasn't involved, No. Do you think they release over 2,000 detainees with criminal records without informing the Secretary of Homeland Security, and she didn't in turn make the president aware of that? They're denying they weren't even aware initially that we're not aware of this. What are you talking about? This was planned, folks. And this is outrageous. They're releasing criminals into your communities. Not 10 or 20 or 30, hundreds across the country. You see, they had funds, and they still have funds, to incarcerate 34,000. Memos went out to get the number around 25,000. So they started to release them before the sequester even began. And they're saying, well, that's the result of this. We don't have money. That's the sequester. And this is what they do. This is unconscionable. This is a jailbreak. You know, Texas Governor Rick Perry was at the CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference. They have a conference every March, an annual conference. And you usually have a number of governors, senators, representatives speak before it. It's primarily for conservative activists, libertarian activists. A lot of young people attend. And Governor Rick Perry gave a speech where he pointed this out. You know, it's a federally sponsored jailbreak. And that's exactly what it is. You know, I think this is an impeachable offense. That's my own opinion. Now, I think he's going to be impeached? No. But the Congress has oversight responsibility, and this will be investigated. Because I don't think if you're in a local community, how would you like to know? Well, guess what? We released 100 illegal, I'll call them undocumented workers, the politically correct term, they're not, as far as I'm concerned, I'm using the term that the statute books use. And that's, they are illegal aliens. And I'll go a step further. They're criminal aliens. You know, if you've ever published in a newspaper or worked for a newspaper, they have what's called AP, Associated Press style book. And to give you an example, I wrote an article, and they give what they prefer the term is. Their preferred term is, got to get this right. Well, they don't like illegal aliens, so that's not the preferred term. Nor do they like undocumented workers. I'm trying to think. I don't have the book in front of me. Maybe I shouldn't have brought it up. I believe what they prefer is undocumented, I could be wrong on this, immigrants. They don't, see, technically, by federal stature and regulation, they are illegal aliens. They're in this country illegally, and that's what I say. And remember, preferred just means, I can use my term, they prefer use, you know, look it up. They're taking sort of the middle position. But I use what the law says they are called, as well as what the regulations say. And it's always been aliens. And they are criminals. They've broken the law. And they're sitting in a detention center to basically be adjudicated, and some will be deported, and some will go to prison. And like I said, it's not easy to get into those establishments. But that is finally come out that we're not talking hundreds, we're talking thousands, and we're probably going to have several thousand more. And, you know, Congress is up in arms about this. I'm sure local communities are upset about this. Some of these are hardened criminals. They're not. It's not Jose and Mary that sneaked across the border to do a janitor's job, find work as a janitor. No, we're talking criminals here. They have felonies either in this country or abroad, or several misdemeanors. How you like that? You know, if you look at some are murderers. I'm not saying released, but if you look at who are the detainees, you have murderers, sex offenders, people of robbery, assaults. You know, it's hard to get in those detention centers because they don't want to have a lot of them. It costs money, and we have them across the United States. Well, it looks like I'm definitely out of time. I hope you enjoyed today's show. It was only an hour and a half as opposed to the regular two-hour show. I will be back not next Friday but the following Friday at the regular time of Friday from 3 to 5 approximately. Most of my listeners listen to me as a podcast, and the way you get to that podcast is promptpops.wordpress.com. At the very top, you'll have a link. Now, I'm going to really rush, so I need to get off the air. I'm going to try to get it posted today. If not, it'll probably be at least not this Monday, but the following Monday before I get it up. So I'm warning you, you might not be able to get it, but I'm going to make a good college try. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas, with a voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of anyone at KDUX, Richland College, or the DCCD. Enjoy your spring break, and now back to the music.